A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's 7 years out from gallbladder surgery, and the bloating after fatty meals is still the thing that gets him. Standard advice is, eat smaller meals, and it works, except right now he's in the middle of moving apartments, doing most of it himself, and his body's suddenly demanding calories like he's back in his weightlifting days. The question is, what do you eat when your body can't handle fat? But you need to eat like a weightlifter. He wants big, filling meals, heavy on protein, low on fat, nutritionally varied. And he wants them designed to work with post-cholecystectomy physiology, not against it.
This is exactly the kind of challenge I love. Because most people hear low fat after gallbladder removal and immediately think sad, tiny, joyless plates of steamed vegetables. But Daniel's asking the right question. He's not just trying to avoid pain, he's trying to fuel serious physical demand. And the physiology here is genuinely interesting. When your gallbladder is gone, you don't get that concentrated squirt of bile when fat hits your duodenum. Instead, the liver just drips bile continuously into the small intestine like a leaky faucet. Your fat emulsification capacity drops by somewhere between 50 and 70%.
The bile's there, just never in the right amount at the right time.
And that mismatch is what causes the misery. Undigested fat sails through to the colon, where bacteria feast on it and produce gas. That's the bloating. It's not mysterious, it's bacterial fermentation of fat that never got broken down. But here's what makes Daniel's situation different from standard low-fat diet advice. He needs volume. He needs calories. He's hauling boxes and furniture all day. You can't fuel that on 6 tiny meals of rice cakes and hope.
The leaky faucet meets the furnace.
That's the tension. And the solution isn't just eat less fat. We need to think about what bile actually does beyond fat digestion, because it's doing a lot more than most people realize. And that's where the meal design gets clever.
We're going to build actual meals here. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, quantified with gram amounts that work with the physiology instead of fighting it.
We're going to talk about why certain fats behave differently, why zero fat is actually a mistake, and how to use things like MCT oil strategically. This isn't a list of sad diet food. These are meals for someone who's physically working hard and needs real fuel.
Let's get into it.
Let's start with what's actually happening when that meal hits the gut. In a normal gallbladder, bile gets concentrated. The gallbladder pulls water out of it, so you're storing this potent, detergent-like fluid. When fat enters the duodenum, the gallbladder contracts and dumps a concentrated bolus. It's a fire hose, not a drip. Without that organ, the liver just keeps producing bile at a steady baseline rate, and it trickles in unconcentrated.
You've got the same total volume over 24 hours, but it's arriving at the wrong concentration and the wrong moment.
And that's why the emulsification capacity drops so dramatically, 50 to 70% less effective at breaking fat into those tiny droplets pancreatic lipase can work on. A normal meal with 25 grams of fat might only have about 10 grams properly emulsified. The rest passes through untouched.
Which is the stuff that ends up in the colon throwing a party for bacteria.
Bacterial fermentation of undigested fat produces gas, hydrogen, methane, sometimes carbon dioxide. That's the distension, the discomfort, the thing that makes you want to lie down after eating. And Daniel's 7 years out, which means this isn't some short-term adaptation problem. This is the permanent physiology now.
What makes this situation trickier than the standard advice is that eat smaller meals works by reducing the total fat load per meal so the drip can handle it. But he's physically working, moving apartments, hauling things, and small meals don't cut it when your body's demanding 3,000 calories a day.
That's where standard low-fat advice falls apart. Most low-fat diets are designed for weight loss or heart health. They assume you're trying to eat fewer calories. Daniel needs the opposite. He needs calorie density without fat density. That's a much harder needle to thread because fat is normally how you add calories without adding bulk. Remove the fat and suddenly you're eating enormous volumes of food to hit your energy needs.
The physics of it is almost funny. You're trying to cram enough fuel into a system that punishes you for using the most efficient fuel source.
That's why we need to think about protein as the organizing principle here. When fat is restricted, protein becomes the primary driver of satiety. There's decent research on this, the protein leverage hypothesis, but it also becomes your main lever for meal size. A chicken breast has the same satiety punch as a much fattier cut of meat, but with a fraction of the bile demand.
Here's what I find interesting. Bile isn't just a detergent for fat. It's doing signaling work too, and that's where the Just Eat Zero Fat advice gets medically sloppy.
This is the part I wish more post-op patients were told. Bile acids are actually hormones in their own right. They bind to two receptors, FXR and TGR5, that are scattered throughout the gut, the liver, even the brain. When bile acids hit these receptors, they're sending messages about metabolic state. FXR activation, for example, regulates glucose metabolism. It influences how the liver handles sugar, how sensitive your tissues are to insulin. TGR5 activation affects gut motility and the release of GLP-1, which is one of the satiety hormones that tells your brain you've eaten enough.
If you're eating almost no fat, you're not just missing calories. You're dialing down an entire signaling system.
And in someone like Daniel, who's physically working hard, insulin sensitivity and satiety signaling actually matter. You don't want to be constantly hungry because your GLP-1 response is blunted. You don't want your glucose regulation getting sloppy because FXR isn't getting activated enough. This is why zero fat is a mistake. You need enough fat to trigger these pathways, just not so much that you overwhelm the emulsification capacity.
What's the threshold where the signaling happens without the bloating?
The sweet spot seems to be around 10 to 15 grams of fat per meal for most post-cholecystectomy patients. Below 10, you're probably not getting much receptor activation. Above 15, you're likely exceeding what the continuous bile drip can handle, and undigested fat starts heading for the colon. It's a window, not a cliff, but it's a real window.
Within that window, not all fats are equal. MCTs keep coming up.
Medium-chain triglycerides are fascinating. They're absorbed completely differently from the long-chain fats that make up most of our dietary fat. Long-chain triglycerides, the kind in olive oil, butter, meat fat, those require bile emulsification, then they get packaged into chylomicrons and travel through the lymphatic system. It's a whole production. MCTs, because their carbon chains are shorter, get absorbed directly into the portal vein and shuttled straight to the liver. No bile required. No lymphatic detour.
They're a calorie delivery system that completely bypasses the broken part of the machinery.
8 grams of MCT oil gives you about 70 calories that hit your bloodstream fast, with zero demand on the bile system. For someone trying to add calories without adding fat that needs emulsifying, it's almost like a cheat code. You can drizzle it on oatmeal, blend it into a protein shake, mix it into non-fat yogurt. The caveat is that some people still get digestive upset from MCTs, it's individual. But for many post-gallbladder patients, it's useful.
Then there's the protein side of the equation, which I know you've got thoughts on.
The protein leverage hypothesis is relevant here. When dietary fat is restricted, protein becomes the primary signal for satiety. Your body basically uses protein intake as a proxy for meal completeness. But here's the wrinkle. After gallbladder removal, CCK signaling gets altered. CCK is the hormone that normally triggers gallbladder contraction, but it also stimulates stomach acid and pepsin production. When that signaling is disrupted post-op, you can end up with compromised protein digestion.
The very thing you're relying on for satiety is also harder to digest properly.
Which is why protein source selection matters more than people realize. You want proteins that are inherently easy to break down. Egg whites at about 11 grams of protein per 100 grams, with less than 0.2 grams of fat, non-fat Greek yogurt at 10 grams of protein per 100 grams, with under half a gram of fat, white fish, chicken breast. These are proteins that don't demand heroic amounts of stomach acid.
The cooking method becomes part of the nutritional strategy, not just a preference.
Poaching, steaming, air frying, grilling, anything that doesn't introduce additional fat. A 200-gram chicken breast has about 4 grams of fat. That same weight of 93.7 ground beef has 22 grams. That's a 5.5 times difference, and it's the difference between staying inside the 10 to 15 gram window and blowing right past it before you've even added anything else to the plate.
The meal design principle is essentially maximize protein density per calorie while keeping total fat inside that 10 to 15 gram window and use MCTs strategically to add calories without adding bile demand.
Don't go to zero because you need those bile acid receptors firing to maintain glucose metabolism and satiety signaling. It's not just about avoiding pain, it's about actually supporting the metabolic demands of heavy physical work.
With that biology in mind, let's build some meals that actually work.
Breakfast is where most people default to eggs fried in butter or bacon, so this is the meal that needs the most rethinking. Let me give you three that actually work. First, an egg white scramble. 200 grams of liquid egg whites, that's about 22 grams of protein with basically zero fat. The trick for creaminess, and this is one of those things that sounds wrong until you try it, is folding in 100 grams of non-fat Greek yogurt right at the end, off the heat. It gives you that rich, almost cheesy texture without adding fat. Throw in 100 grams of diced bell peppers and a handful of spinach. Total, about 35 grams of protein, under 3 grams of fat.
Yogurt and scrambled eggs. I'm trying to decide if that's genius or a cry for help.
It's both, and it works. Second option, oatmeal engineered for protein. 80 grams of rolled oats, 30 grams of vanilla protein powder stirred in after cooking, 200 milliliters of unsweetened almond milk, topped with 100 grams of blueberries. Then the strategic move. 1 tablespoon of MCT oil drizzled on top. That gets you to about 40 grams of protein, 8 grams of fat, and most of that fat is the MCT that bypasses the bile system entirely.
The MCT adds calories without adding bulk, which is what you were saying about the volume problem.
70 calories from that tablespoon alone. Third breakfast, protein pancakes. 2 scoops of a whey casein blend, 1 egg white, 50 grams of oat flour, enough water to make a batter. Cook them on a non-stick pan, no oil needed. Serve with sugar-free syrup and 100 grams of non-fat Greek yogurt on the side. That's another 35 to 40 grams of protein, and the fat is negligible.
Lunch is where I feel like people run out of ideas fastest. You can only eat so many plain chicken breasts before you start resenting your own kitchen.
The deconstructed sushi bowl solves that. 200 grams of steamed whitefish, cod or tilapia works beautifully, on top of 150 grams of cooked sushi rice. Add 100 grams of cucumber, 50 grams of shredded carrot, a splash of soy sauce, and here's the key, 1 teaspoon of sesame oil. That's about 5 grams of fat total, but the sesame oil gives you that actual sushi flavor. 40 plus grams of protein, and it feels like a real meal, not a compromise.
1 teaspoon of sesame oil carrying the entire flavor identity of a cuisine. That's efficiency.
It's exactly the kind of strategic fat use we talked about. Enough to trigger those receptors, not enough to cause trouble. Second munch, high-protein chili. 200 grams of 99% lean ground turkey, a 400-gram can of diced tomatoes, 200 grams of kidney beans, chili spices. 45 grams of protein, 4 grams of fat. You can make a huge batch and eat it for days. Third, a chicken and quinoa power bowl. 200 grams of grilled chicken breast, 150 grams of cooked quinoa, 100 grams of steamed broccoli, 50 grams of roasted red peppers, and 2 tablespoons of balsamic vinegar. 50 grams of protein, 6 grams of fat.
The quinoa is doing double duty. It's a complete protein on its own, plus it adds the carbohydrate volume that helps with satiety when fat is low.
Dinner is where you want something that feels substantial, especially after a day of physical work. Baked cod with herb crust, 250 grams of cod fillet topped with 30 grams of panko breadcrumbs, dried herbs, lemon juice. No butter, no oil. The lemon juice and herbs do the heavy lifting. Serve with 200 grams of roasted asparagus and 150 grams of sweet potato, 45 grams of protein, 3 grams of fat.
Sweet potato is smart there. Dense carbohydrate, actual flavor, and it roasts without oil if you just give it enough time.
Second dinner, lean beef stir-fry. 150 grams of sirloin steak trimmed of visible fat stir-fried with 200 grams of mixed vegetables. Sauce is low-sodium soy sauce, ginger, garlic, and 1 teaspoon of sesame oil. 40 grams of protein, 8 grams of fat. The sirloin gives you that red meat satisfaction without blowing the fat budget.
The third one? You mentioned a lasagna situation with zucchini.
Turkey and vegetable lasagna using zucchini strips instead of pasta. 200 grams of 99% lean ground turkey. 300 grams of zucchini sliced lengthwise into thin strips, 200 grams of crushed tomatoes, 100 grams of non-fat ricotta, Italian herbs. Layer it like a traditional lasagna and bake. 50 grams of protein, 5 grams of fat. The zucchini releases water as it cooks, so it stays moist without needing oil or cheese.
The snack's where I think people lose the thread. You've nailed 3 solid meals, but if you're burning through calories moving furniture, you need bridges between them.
Protein ice cream is my favorite weird trick. 1 scoop of casein protein, 200 milliliters of unsweetened almond milk, a handful of ice, blended until it's thick. Casein makes it creamy in a way whey doesn't. 25 grams of protein, under 1 gram of fat, and it tastes like dessert.
Casein's the slow digesting one, right? So it also keeps you full longer.
Which is exactly what you want between meals during heavy physical work. 2 more quick ones, rice cakes with 2 tablespoons of non-fat Greek yogurt and everything bagel seasoning. Crunchy, savory, almost zero fat. And cold sweet potato slices dipped in non-fat Greek yogurt mixed with cinnamon. The sweet potato gives you slow-release carbohydrate, the yogurt adds protein, and the whole thing feels like a snack rather than a medical intervention.
If you ran these meals across a full day, say the oatmeal for breakfast, the chili for lunch, the stir-fry for dinner, plus a couple of those snacks, you'd be pushing close to 3,000 calories while staying under 30 grams of total fat for the day.
That's the real proof of concept. You can fuel serious physical work on a post-gallbladder diet. It just requires being deliberate about where every gram of fat comes from and making sure it's doing something useful. Flavor, signaling, or both, rather than just sneaking in through cooking oil or fattier cuts of meat.
Let's boil this down to a few rules you can carry with you. The concept I keep coming back to is a bile budget. You got roughly 10 to 15 grams of fat per meal before you exceed what that continuous drip can handle. Spend those grams on things that earn their place. A teaspoon of sesame oil that makes a rice bowl taste like actual food. A tablespoon of MCT oil that adds 70 calories without touching the budget at all.
Allocate that budget to the meals where fat does the most work for you. For a lot of people, breakfast or the post-workout meal is where they tolerate fat best. The gut seems less reactive earlier in the day, and after exercise, gastric emptying slows in a way that can make fat digestion marginally more efficient. Save your heavier fat spends for those windows.
The second rule is protein pacing. 30 to 40 grams per meal, minimum. That's not just for satiety, though that matters enormously when fat is low. It's for muscle protein synthesis during high demand periods. Daniel's moving apartments. His muscles are getting micro damage all day. If he's not hitting that threshold at each meal, he's leaving recovery on the table.
Remember what we said about protein source selection. Egg whites, non-fat Greek yogurt, white fish, chicken breast, lean turkey. These are your workhorses. They deliver the protein without dragging fat along for the ride. A 200-gram chicken breast gives you 40-plus grams of protein and 4 grams of fat. That same protein from a ribeye would come with 30 grams of fat and an afternoon of regret.
The third rule is MCTs and non-fat dairy as your calorie amplifiers. They add energy density without bile demand. But, and this is the individual tolerance piece, some people's guts still rebel against MCTs even without the gallbladder in the picture. Start with a teaspoon, not a tablespoon, and see how you respond.
The supplement piece is worth mentioning, not as a daily crutch, but as a safety net. A digestive enzyme containing lipase can be useful for those occasional meals where you know you're going to exceed your fat budget, a dinner out, a social situation where you can't control the cooking. It won't replace a gallbladder, but it can take the edge off. More importantly, if you're eating very low fat long term, you need to be deliberate about fat-soluble vitamins. A, D, E, and K require some dietary fat for absorption, and when you're consistently under 30 grams a day, you can drift into insufficiency without realizing it.
A decent multivitamin that covers those 4 is not medical paranoia. It's covering a known gap in the system.
And that's really the unifying principle here. You're not just avoiding pain. You're engineering a diet that compensates for a missing organ while still fueling serious physical output. The bile budget keeps you inside the safety zone. The protein pacing maintains muscle and satiety. The MCTs and non-fat dairy give you calorie flexibility, and the supplements fill the known cracks.
There's one question I keep circling back to, and it's the long game. We've talked about managing day-to-day, the bile budget, the protein pacing, but what happens after 10 years of eating this way? The gut microbiome is plastic. It adapts to what you feed it. If you're consistently eating under 30 grams of fat a day, you're essentially starving the bacterial species that specialize in fat metabolism.
We don't know what the consequences of that are. There's some preliminary work suggesting that long-term, very low-fat diets shift the Firmicutes to Bacteroidetes ratio, which sounds like jargon but has real metabolic implications. Those phyla influence everything from energy extraction to inflammation. But nobody has done the longitudinal study on post-cholecystectomy patients specifically. It's a research gap the size of a crater.
We're operating partly in the dark, even with all the mechanistic understanding we've got.
Which is why I'd love to hear from listeners who've been navigating this for years. If you've found a high-protein, low-fat meal combination that works for you, especially if you're active, if you're training, if you're doing physical work, send it in. Daniel's not the only one trying to solve this puzzle, and honestly, the collective knowledge out there probably exceeds what any single study has captured.
The show's whole premise is that these weird, specific health challenges deserve real answers. Not generic advice, not eat smaller meals and hope for the best. So, if you've got something that works, we want to hear it. We might even feature the best ones in a follow-up.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1928, beekeepers in what is now South Sudan began marketing white acacia honey from the acacia sayal tree, naming it after the gum arabic trade that dominated the region's economy during the interwar period.
I don't know what to do with that.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who's trying to figure out how to eat well when their body changed the rules on them. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll be back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.